ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Robin Hauser, director and producer of cause-based documentary films at Finish Line Features and president of Unleash Productions. Robin's most recent documentary, Bias, explores unconscious bias and how it affects us socially and in the workplace. She has also spoken about the importance of diversity and inclusion, the importance of ethics and artificial intelligence, and on behalf of women's rights at conferences like TED, Watermark, Conference for Women, Mobile World Congress, South by Southwest, and more. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Let's begin just briefly for people who aren't familiar with your work. You have great experience as a businesswoman, director, social entrepreneur, and photographer. Can you tell me a little bit about sort of the Cliff Notes version of how you got where you are today?
Yeah, you know, I've always had an interest in photography. I've been a photographer since I think one of those mini courses that I took maybe in grade school. And I guess it's always just been a hobby, but I've thought in the back of my mind for a very long time, someday I want to make a film. Someday I want to, you know, combine that, my love for photography, and join it together and have it be some, you know, visual storytelling. And it really just sort of fell into my lap, so to speak, in 2010, when my daughter was running cross country and there was an incident that happened with her coach who had Lou Gehrig's disease, and everything just sort of came together. And there was some documentarians that approached me to see if I wanted to get involved. And I thought, well, as long as my daughter was going to be involved, I might as well get in there and make sure the story is told correctly and shine a light on the need to find a cure for Lou Gehrig's disease. And that was my first project. And since then, I fell in love with cause-based documentary filmmaking.
Right. That actually is a perfect segue into what inspired you to focus on that, because obviously putting picture with storytelling could be a wide variety of things, but are you most passionate about sharing these stories, which aren't necessarily particularly well known, but are also based very much in reality?
Yeah, I was raised by two parents who have always given back to society, to community, to, you know, to the world, and they've left that sort of responsibility on me in a way, I should say they've instilled that responsibility on me, which I really appreciate. And so being able to combine, you know, a love for visual storytelling and for cinematography, and then also for just being able to give back and to raise awareness about issues that might not be known, but to really try to inspire change in a different way, right? So in order to tell a story that might make somebody view the world through different eyes and maybe even inspire them to change, to become better or to help. So I hate to say to raise awareness, because I think that term's become so cliche, but that's exactly what this is, right? I mean, it's really just about to tell a story. I also am really inspired. I do have a business background. And, you know, I think I sort of cringe when I hear people refer to some of the work that I do as, you know, corporate videos, because they are so not corporate videos. But if I have an audience, you know, in addition to your average person, the average audience, if I have a corporate audience as well, then, you know, what better way to share a story than through sort of the conduit of corporate America? And, you know, people, some of the really big policymakers and some of the people who are highly influential in this world. So,
well, I think there you've got your own bias against sort of industrials or corporate films, right?
No, I think that's exactly right. It is interesting to me that when I think about a corporate training video, I mean, come on, how many of us have sat in those rooms and seen a corporate with really bad actors and really poorly written, and they try to maybe an attempt at humor, but it doesn't really land. And half of us are looking at our watches thinking, you know, when can I leave? When's lunch? And I find it interesting that I didn't I don't make the films that I make for corporate audience, but I have found that audience and that these films are really appreciated. Like I said, in addition to film festivals, in addition to universities and colleges, and you're just your average, you know, movie lover off the street. But it's really fascinating to be able to share these stories and have it be more effective maybe in creating open awareness about issues than it would be if it were just, you know, a mandatory training video.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so your latest film, Bias, highlights the nature of implicit bias and the grip it holds on social and professional lives and what it takes to induce change. And I'm curious, when you were making the film, were you surprised by anything that you discovered about yourself or about biases in general?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a few things. I would say the most interesting thing that I learned about unconscious bias and pretty much bias just globally is that the brain science behind it shows that while we can easily see bias in other people, we have a very difficult time identifying our own biases, especially our implicit or hidden biases. And so most of us consider ourselves to be much less biased than we actually are. And I did quite a number of on-the-street interviews, just random people that I would see in all sorts of different places around the U.S. And I would ask people, I would say, you know, do you consider yourself to be biased? And they'd say, no, no. And I'd say, well, what about your friends and family? Do you see sometimes that they're biased? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'll ask them, well, what type of bias? Well, racial, religious, gender, you know, all these different forms of bias. And so I asked brain scientists about this, and they said that just like we can't do two math problems in our head at once, as humans, we have that limitation. We also don't have the ability to recognize biases in us that might influence our decisions, but we don't know that they're there. Like, we might be openly aware about some of our biases. I might know that I'm biased against golden retrievers because I was bit by one when I was young. But how many biases do I have that I'm not aware of? And I can tell you there are many. The other really surprising thing for me that I actually expose in the film is I subject myself to the implicit association test and to a few different experiments that are done on unconscious bias. And on screen, I uncovered that I showed a strong association of women and family and men and career. Now, I consider myself to be a feminist, a womanist, and that to me was very surprising that I outwardly appreciate and believe, strongly believe, that women should be able to do anything they want to do. They should be able to be anything they want to be, and that they are capable of that. And so to see that I have some implicit association that women relate more to family than men do, and that men relate more to career than women do, was really surprising to me. And this all was revealed in the implicit association test that any one of you can take online. It's called the IAT.org. And it's a fascinating test.
Ooh, now I'm writing that down. I've got to do it myself. One thing I'm curious about, though, is bias itself as a word is sort of has a lot of pejorative connotations. And how much do you think, I mean, it's very rare that somebody is going to say, yeah, I'm biased, you know, because you don't want to admit to somebody who's interviewing you that you have biases, even if you know secretly that you do, you know? And I guess the question is, are bias, so there's that sort of, is bias, if everybody has it, is it always a pejorative? And is it possible actually to be bias neutral? Is that even possible?
Well, so these are a lot of the questions that we raise in the film. And here's what we know. You know, bias at its core is a survival heuristic. There are reasons that we have bias. We learn from experience. So, you know, if we were struck by lightning because we were out on a golf course swinging around a golf club or something, we're going to learn the next time that we probably shouldn't go out when it looks like it's going to storm. Right? And we learn if I had a bad experience walking down a dark alley in a town I'm not familiar with, I'll think twice about walking down an alley at night, won't I? And these are things that we do because we learn from experience, which is a good thing because you can imagine how long it would take us to accomplish anything in this world if we had to start from a blank slate every time, if we didn't let our experience influence our decisions in some way. So the question that the film raises is this useful in the modern world, right? And to what extent now do our snap judgments, our automatic assumptions, to what extent are those useful? And to what extent do they sort of impede us or marginalize us from having a really diverse either workforce or social group? You know, and why does that even matter, right? Those are some of the questions. So for instance, something's called like me bias. If I had to hire somebody, and you know, as a business person, like all of us, we're busy. We have too much on our plate all the time. And so we want to take shortcuts and we want to just expedite chores that we have or things that we have to do. So if we have to hire somebody, you're just going to say, great, pull me, you know, 5 candidates and I'll just go through them really quickly. And so somebody walks in my office and they happen to have grown up in the Bay Area. They went to UC Berkeley, they like to run, they like to ski in the winter. And I think, oh my gosh, I'm so comfortable with this person. This person is like me. It's easy for me because I like this person. Now, I might not check the references of that person as carefully as I would check the references of a person who isn't like me, for example. I might not ask the same interview questions to the person who just feels so familiar to me and so, you know, seems so comfortable with me. And that is something that we all tend to do. It's called like me bias. I automatically want to hire that person first because I just feel really comfortable. They're in my in-group. But the truth is that might not be the best person to hire. And certainly if I'm just creating sort of a cocoon of yes around me, a cocoon of comfort around me of like-minded individuals, it is certainly not going to help my company or the products that we create, because without a diverse group, there's a big chance that you're not going to be able to think globally enough to serve, say, the greatest breadth of humanity, right?
Right. So is this sort of, when we talk about corporate fit, when we're interviewing and or fitting into the corporate culture, are those, is the like me bias inherently going to be baked into that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that's probably not the best way for us to look at it. Rather, what type of contribution, how will that candidate contribute to our culture? So what newness or more interesting, what is their contribution? What would their contribution be to our culture? Rather than we define our corporate culture as A, B, and C, and everybody has to fit into that, which is what creates things like, you know, Silicon Valley, where it's predominantly white and male.
So a question, though, that your white male Silicon Valley guys will say is, yeah, and we're totally successful. So what's the problem? I mean, and how do you argue with them there? I agree that I think it needs to be far more diverse. And yet I'm stumped a bit when they point to their own success. And do you say, well, you would be more successful? It's just the right thing to do. What is the response? How do you address it in a way that's convincing to people who, if they don't recognize their own bias, how do you talk to them about that bias and get them to adjust?
Right. So, I mean, I think those are really good points. And it is hard to look at Google or Facebook and say to them, you know, you would be more successful if you were more diverse, because they're plenty successful. So is there an argument that they could be more successful? Absolutely. Look, for example, at Google, and if you were to do an online search, an image search with Google for the word grandma, what you pull up are predominantly 99% white, older white women. And that is not representative on a global scale of what it means to be a grandma. I was recently in the Middle East, and I asked them on Google in Arabic to write the word for grandmother in Arabic. And again, it pulled up predominantly older white women. And I said to them, it was fascinating. And I said to this was in a classroom, and I said to these high school students, can anybody find anybody on that page that looks like their grandmother? And they all
said, wow. That's amazing. I would have thought there would have been some regional variation that it, obviously I'm wrong, but I'm assuming machine learning. And is it just simply because, gee whiz, Google came from America and therefore the vast majority?
So there is some, I mean, chances of finding a grandma in a, you know, abaya are greater, obviously, if you Google it in Arabic, but then it would be in the United States, but it's still predominantly older white women, which was just shocking to me. And this goes to something a little different. What this is important to realize that the diversity in upper management, the issue about diversity in upper management at Google is a little bit different than saying, how come when we do a search and through word embedding, it's showing us something that seems very homogeneous. So they're two different issues, but they're certainly related. If you had more diversity in management at some of these tech companies, I think that they would realize the importance for having some sort of oversight as to data input to make sure that that data input were more diverse. Because what really happens if you want to get into it sort of technically is that once that data gets baked into deep learning machines, it's very hard to get it out. And so if you were going to rely on data that you're getting from the internet and you do a search for that and you see all older white women or predominantly older white women when you see, you know, grandma, and you take that statistic then and build it into some sort of an algorithm that's going to maybe then make medical decisions for medicine or something about grandmas, you can see that that's clearly problematic and that's not a fair representation.
Well, I saw it was a panel with Francesca Rossi and Garry Kasparov talking about AI and bias and how the idea that maybe you could have some sort of certification that had been non-biased. And Garry Kasparov's position was, you can't because even the certifiers will be biased. And also you're going to have bad actors and you have to create sort of walled garden. It was interesting that he just didn't seem to think it was possible to do it. And Francesca thought that it was. Now, how do you feel about that? Is it possible to manipulate these systems to be non-biased, or are we in our manipulation also biasing them just in a different way?
Yeah, well, I'll preface this by saying that I'm not a software engineer and that I think that Garry and Francesca are both much more knowledgeable about it than I am. I will tell you that I think as long as there's a human element, it's going to be very difficult to strip bias from algorithms. So I think they're both right. And I think that I understand what Gary's saying is that, look, the human element, we cannot strip bias from ourselves. And I believe, having interviewed Francesca, that what she's saying is it should not be technically completely impossible to strip bias from machines. But in order to do so, we have to have some sort of governance or oversight, and we have to start acting on that really soon. And I think that was one of the most surprising things. Another very surprising thing I learned making this film was that there is bias in artificial intelligence. And to me, that was, I mean, I really wanted to believe that, okay, if we're human and we're biased and we're going to have a hard time getting over that, then maybe the answer is artificial intelligence. You know, maybe this is a super solution to solve for human error. And the big question then is, do we want artificial intelligence to represent the world the way it is today? So in other words, to say that this is, you know, according to the internet and according to data input from those people, those all of us that put data into search engines and everything, most grandmas are older white women. Or do we want artificial intelligence to represent an ideal situation with complete and total equity and equality? And I think that that is where I was hoping AI was going. I was hoping that we could try to get over some of our own human issues and errors and have artificial intelligence solve for that. But it's not showing to be that way. Search engines are another example. You know, we've seen that Microsoft in 2015 misidentified two African Americans as gorillas. And, you know, clearly that now, I mean, these companies, of course, apologize and they don't intend to do this, but it's a problem because I believe that a lot of these companies in this race to create the newest new thing are serving us with these apps and these newfangled technology that are only half baked and they're not fully vetted or tested. And therefore, we have these problems that are coming up, right? I mean, it's horribly offensive to many people if you're identified as a gorilla rather than as a human being. And
I would say it'd be pretty offensive to anybody. Yeah. It's just whoa.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and I'll give you one more example that I use in my TED talk, but I think this is really telling. If you use Google Translate, for example, and you, if I happen to be, my native language is Finnish or Estonian or Turkish, so gender neutral languages, and I say the doctor cared for its patient, the automatic translation in English is the doctor cared for his patient. So the computer makes the assumption that the doctor is a male, and it does that not necessarily intentionally, it does that through word embedding. And it knows that when the word doctor comes up, most often it's used with male pronouns, and therefore it chooses the male pronoun. And of course, if you change the word nurse, a doctor to nurse, the pronoun, the assumed pronoun in Google Translate is female. So it's, you know, she or her. So what does that do? It just says that, well, it is true. In the United States, there are more male doctors than there are female doctors, and there are more female nurses than there are male nurses. So it's going to make that assumption. But that's not how we want the world to be in the future.
Right. But I guess the thing is then, what happens if, because we do have gendered pronouns, and if we're hoping for equity, should it just be a random assignment? This time it's a he, that time it's a she? I mean, how do we deal with gendered language in a equal society?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have two choices. You would say his/her or her/his, or you would say it, or you would say it's, I guess. You know, and then of course that brings up the whole other argument that there are some people that don't identify with either male or female gender. And so we have to be sensitive to that too. And that gets into a whole different discussion. But I just think that it's fascinating that what a lot of this software is doing and a lot of this artificial intelligence is doing is that it is perpetuating societal stereotypes.
Well, really it's sort of solidifying them and putting them into, well, the computer told me, and it's a computer. So it can't be biased. You know, it just as you thought, the computer is not going to be biased. I think people tend to believe the truth, you know, that there is sort of this ideal, Platonic ideal truth, and that computers are much more liable to get it that way, that it's not human, it's an algorithm, as if there isn't a human hand somewhere in the algorithm, or even that it's just reflecting human behavior in one way or another. It's interesting also in light of, you know, currently the Me Too movement, where there's a real dam breaking in terms of women finally saying, you know, enough, we want to change how things are said out loud and what we talk about in public spaces, at the same time as we have a government where, in the United States at least, a lot of people are feeling more comfortable sort of letting their bias run free, if you will. I wonder if those two things are related. I mean, you had also, switching gears from bias, you had also earned success with code debugging the gender gap. And I'm wondering, They're obviously related things, but is there anything around gender in specific that was slightly different than the bias film? Like, what was the central thesis there?
Well, right. So the central thesis for code debugging the gender gap was really my wanting to find out why there weren't more women in tech. Why aren't there more female software engineers? And is it something physiological? I mean, at first when I was looking into this, I really didn't know. I didn't think that was the case, but I certainly had to rule that out. Is there something different with the female brain that would make us, you know, not as capable of programmers as a man? And clearly that's not the case. But I wanted to know what was happening here. You know, what's interesting is coming off of what we were just talking about is that gender stereotypes play a big role in one of the reasons why most women don't pursue computer science and software engineering. There's, you know, societal stereotypes, there are lack of role models, there's, you know, pipeline issue. I mean, there are a lot of different reasons that women don't pursue computer science. What's so surprising to me is that by the year 2020, there will be over 1 million unfilled computer science related jobs in the US alone. And these are really high paying, good jobs. And the fact that, you know, we are bringing in foreigners to fill these jobs, go down to Silicon Valley, you'll see. I mean, it's predominantly South. There are, aside from American men, there's a huge number of Southeast Asians that are coming in on the H-1 visa.
Well, it's interesting. I worked in international deployment when I was consulting for a while, and absolutely. And it was something that started really to irritate me because I thought, really, truly, we don't have anyone here who can fill these roles? I mean, it seems, you know, unemployment is high and we can't all be that stupid, right? I mean, there's got to be a way to make it. I am curious, going back, it's kind of a nice, you know, relating to your own, when you had taken your own implicit bias and you had connected women with family. Women biologically have children. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad, you know, thing. People have children. And if you are having children and you take time with children, is there an element of women making choices, not based on opportunities given, but they want to maybe spend time with kids and then it's difficult to re-enter, that there's ageism that plays a part, that it's hard to step out and step back in, that it isn't necessarily as flexible. And that's for any parent, whoever stays, whoever child minds, whether it's a man who child minds or a woman who child minds.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that, like, there's so many things that are going on, and you're right, you know, for the foreseeable future anyway, women are the only gender that can perpetuate the human race, right? That can propagate the human race. And this is important. So it's a privilege, it's a gift. But why should that be a penalty, right? So why should that penalize women, especially women in the workforce? So I think that there are countries that are working to do things. This is what I call the mommy penalty. Lots of people call this the mommy penalty. But I mean, and it's interesting how it plays out. So it plays out both really subtly in some cases. It plays out, oh, let me give you a couple examples. So if there's a job to fill and it's a promotion, so you've got, let's just say, you know, Mike and Steve sitting around a table trying to decide who they're going to put into that spot. And they say, well, you know, Sarah's the next in line and she's great. They said, yeah, that's true. But, you know, she has young kids and her husband travels tons and this job would, you know, have a bit of travel. So they think about it together and they think, yeah, you're right. You know, Sarah, it'd be too much to ask Sarah to take that on. So, well, what about Patrick? Let's look at Patrick. So right there, they're two well-intended men making a decision for Sarah without ever asking Sarah herself. And I think this type of thing happens all the time. And again, they're well-intended. These men would, if it were brought to their attention, they would likely say, well, wait, we were thinking of her. She's got young kids. She's got a husband that travels. We just know that would be a burden on her. But they don't give her the opportunity to say it herself or to make the decision herself. And I doubt that would happen if it were a man. They would say, hey, look, we got this opportunity. You could take this promotion. It's going to, you know, require travel. We know that you've got kids. We know that you, you know, your wife travels a lot. But they would give him that opportunity. So I think that's something to be aware of. I would also say that there's sometimes really implicit bias. So there was an interesting study done that showed that perceptions, right? So if a woman's not at her desk and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the perception is that she's left to do something with her kids. And it's hard for that not to come into the back of the minds or the forefront of the minds of a promotion manager or manager that's making a decision when thinking about promotion. His mind's like, yeah, well, she cuts out kind of early in the evening or early in the afternoon. Whereas if a man's not at his desk, the assumption is, one, he's at a business meeting, or two, he's traveling for business. So it's fascinating to see that, you know, again, it's really hard for a woman in the workplace who is a mother to not have that somehow work against her.
It's absolutely true. And then there are also, even within the family unit, there are biases. We had an executive producer, and she and her husband both worked, but whenever there was a sick child, our executive producer would leave. And, you know, we were like, hey, you want to split that with your husband a little bit? Because, you know, and so as a business, it was interesting. Be like, hey, you know, this person does have this important role and we have to, as a business, work around this need. But even within their family unit, they have these biases.
Right. I'm hopeful that this is changing with millennials. I believe that they seem to be a little bit more open to non-stereotypical gender roles. So I do hear about, you know, men staying home, women staying home, them both, you know, they have a sick child saying, okay, well, what do you have to do today? What do I have to do today? So I'm really hopeful that that is changing with the millennials. I think that it's still an issue. There's a stigma at the man who stays home and has got the kids in the park, right? There's not a stigma. There's judgment sometimes from a woman that works full time when she's considering a woman that doesn't, or a woman that doesn't work. A mom who doesn't work certainly has judgment about women that work full time. But that's not to say that we carry the same stigma that a man might, at least in, you know, America, if he weren't the primary breadwinner. And those are things we have to get over. So there's some interesting things being done in certain countries. I know that Finland has already initiated this. I believe Sweden, and I know that Estonia is looking into it. And that is looking into, if you're going to have mandatory maternity leave, that you would also have mandatory paternity leave. And there's some rules around it. Like, I believe the first 75 days have to be taken from the mother if she's breastfeeding, so that she's got that, you know, bonding time with her child. After that, the husband can take paternity leave and the woman could go back to work. Mom could go back to work. So there's some really interesting things being done. Now, what this does is it makes it so that an employer wouldn't be biased to hiring a man over a woman, because he or she knows that if this woman were within childbearing years, that they would have to give maternity leave.
Well, I think that that's an interesting...
It equals the field.
Yeah, I think that that's, as an employer, one of the things is right now, in the United States at least, the employer bears the burden of holding a job, replacing a person. And so there is a real cost around, you know, women of childbearing years versus men, you know, in that the man doesn't necessarily go off early. You know, it's an interesting challenge in that understanding not only the bias itself, but also all of the structures that go to reinforce that bias. Before we wrap up, I'm really curious, what is next for you? Do you take, once you've done one of these amazing films, which really does have a cause, do you work in that cause for a while, or are you out finding the next thing that needs to have a light shone on it?
Well, I'm always thinking about the next film. As much as I would like to just travel with this film for the next 2 years, I'm doing private screenings right now. So private corporate screenings or organizational screenings, university screenings while we're on the film festival circuit. But I'm always thinking about the next film. So I'm going to force myself not to start a new film for about a year. I think I owe it to this film and to this cause to be really out there with it for a little while. But yeah, it's hard to not get excited about a new subject.
So if there are some listeners who really want to see your film, how can they see your film?
Well, the first opportunity is the Bentonville Film Festival, which is May 3rd in Bentonville, Arkansas. And that's Gina Davis's film festival, which has a strong theme for diversity, which is really fabulous. And then after that, I know that we will be, well, there's some film festivals I can't announce yet, but look for us on the film festival circuit and, you know, or try to get a private screening at your company or your organization. And you can keep track of screenings on biasfilm.com. We'll list our screenings there.
Are you eventually going to connect with Netflix or Amazon or a company like that so that it can have wider distribution?
Absolutely. So Code Debugging the Gender Gap is on Amazon and Netflix and all sorts of distribution platforms right now. We will absolutely, once we get off the film festival circuit, we will open this up to broader distribution. Yeah. But it'll be a little while.
Okay. Well, very exciting. I can't wait to see the film and also to see what you do next, because obviously it's really engaging and important stuff. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Gabriella, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Robin Hauser. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.